Welcome back to the Blockfuel Podcast. We are with Mike Cahill, CEO of Doro Labs and director of the PIF Data Association. Mike, excited to talk with you today. Welcome to the Blockfuel Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on. Excited to be here.
We always start with just a quick intro to yourself. I know you previously worked at the CBOE, led special projects at Jump Crypto. So we'd love to know a little bit more of the background of what brought you into Doro Labs.
Yeah, so I'm TradFi by background, out of college, Morgan Stanley, FX trading desk, and then worked my way into high-frequency trading firms, and then into Cboe on their FX exchange. Jump Crypto, which is where I really worked in the industry for the first time. At Jump Crypto, you get exposure to a ton of projects, and my thesis going there was that I would be able to be working with like the Steve Jobses of our time when they're still in the garage. And I think that was probably the case because Jump was such a big trader. Yeah. It ended up engaging with everyone. That has been a hugely rewarding experience. And given the maturation of the crypto markets, we got to see the kind of the first generation and then second generation of a lot of different things. The thing that ended up getting me over to Doro Labs was at Jump, we started working on the Fifth Network and realized that there was a gap in the infrastructure that was going to be necessary for crypto to really take off and be set for kind of mainstream institutional usage and then mainstream retail user or just like mainstream adoption. And we'll get into probably some of the nuances of that, but it was just by being exposed at such an early stage and having such a mature view from being the seat of Jump to be able to understand some of the limitations, because you can be in various seats and look at different types of infrastructure and say, you know what, I have no idea if that's going to work or not, but let's give it a shot. The rationale for why the PIF network was needed goes into so many of the nuances of how things like market data works or how the incentive structure works with trading firms and exchanges. And it's really nuanced, but it ends up when you start unpacking it into a very sensible place and you understand why it is so necessary. And because it was such a big project, I ended up going to forming Doro Labs, which is a company that is right now just building out on its network and doing a lot of the development for it.
Amazing. I think from before we get into Doro Labs and PIF specifically, you were leading special projects at Jump Crypto. And that's a name, obviously, is all around the space, is one of the biggest players. What do you do as a role of special projects? Do you have like R&D at Wayne Enterprises or Google X Labs? What are the kind of cool things that you're jumping into and people like the Steve Jobses that you're working with?
Think about it from a crypto projects perspective or builder's perspective. There's so much DeFi that's being built and there's so many application chains or like ecosystems that are built to attract DeFi. And if you were building an exchange, you would want to have the largest trader in the world join your exchange. And so there is just constantly people, and Jump is at the time, and perhaps even today, is the largest crypto trader, largest futures trader. There are other big trading firms that have different sectors as well, like Jane Street and the ETFs. DRW with options, but you just get a lot of inbound from people that are just trying to attract this behemoth. And it's a cool spot to be in. And you get to do a little bit of VC as a result. And it's a bit of VC in the sense of, sure, we can invest some money. This is like really inspiring or exciting idea. But then there's also the benefits of being in crypto where you can earn a position. And if you're like building certain things out, like you can earn a stake in a network. And so one easily kind of way to picture that is what Jump is doing with FireDancer and Solana. So they're building an entire new validator set that's from first principles, the way that they would have written it with all of the latency removed. This guy, Kevin Bowers, who's really a kind of a genius when it comes to networking. And that's going to be complementary to the existing Solana validator and the two will then live. So it's stuff like that where a lot of times people are coming to Jump and saying, I would like to do something with you. And so special projects, you just interface with them and figure out which ones you want to take on.
How does PIF actually work? And in the simplest way, what are you guys doing? And if there is like a non-Web 2, or if there's not like a, or more of a Web 2 type of company that's doing the same thing for traditional markets, what would be analogous to that?
So the analog would be Bloomberg. So yeah. What Bloomberg does is it is a conduit for financial market to be distributed in a highly controlled manner. And it's distributed to largely financial institutions, professional ones, and there is a huge premium on that data. Mm-hmm. And then the data gets further segmented based on the liveness of it. And so the closer you get to the time of zero, the more expensive the data tends to become. And so when you get into the world of high frequency trading, that actually exists outside of Bloomberg even. And those are like the customized, I want to be co-located in the same data center and so on. The reason why Bloomberg is the right analogy and not say Google Finance or Yahoo Finance is because it gives the ability for the exchanges who are the sellers of data in the traditional world, the ability to highly control that distribution mechanism. Whereas like Yahoo Finance and Google Finance are really broad-based distribution mechanisms or platforms, and it's usually uncontrolled distribution that's advertising supported. And so typically the type of data that you're going to get on one of those platforms is delayed by some amount of time. So it's somewhere between 10 to 15 minutes. Now, that's super important because it gives you the nuance around financial data. So Yahoo Finance and Google Finance have never taken off in the professional world. People are willing to pay thousands of dollars per login for a Bloomberg terminal. And the reason for it is that they get access to such better data and that the data is valued at that. There's such a premium that's put on it. Now, what is Pith doing is it's solving the Oracle problem, which is bringing data on chain in a trustworthy way. And a blockchain network has a state. That state is usually who owns what tokens right now. And that state is broadcast to all the validators. Anything that is outside of that state needs to be brought in somehow, and it has to be brought in a trustworthy way because it's not going to be going through the validator set. And that's what oracles do, right? So the reason why Pith was created is that the financial market data business is so big and robust with lots of revenue that we were not seeing a solution that held to that integrity and would ever be able to track that type of data to be brought on chain. So Pith actually innovated in really two ways. The first one was to incentivize owners of data to put that data on chain for the very first time. And instead of going to the kind of the historic sellers of data, which is like the exchanges, it open sourced it a little bit and made it more going to the Airbnbs instead of just to hotels for rooms to stay in. And that looked like trading firms being able to sell their data or publish their data via Pith. So this big innovation was democratizing the sellers of market data or the suppliers of market data to this Oracle solution. That was number one. And then number two was doing so in a way where the data can have equal access across any different blockchain. And it can be pulled on chain or brought in on demand. And that then creates an economic, sustainable economic model so that people are buying data when they need to use it, which is a different model than the Bloomberg one, which is you pay for a subscription and then it's all you can eat via that subscription, but it's one subscription per person. I don't know if a five-year-old understand that, but
yeah, I was gonna say,
I'll try and improve.
Mike, I'd love to get your take on what are some of the existing players out there. People are familiar with Chainlink and how they're solving price feeds. They're around last bull market. So people hold on to these ideas of different use cases and who the players are in them. How does Pith and Dora Labs think about things differently than how Chainlink would approach the problem?
Yeah, so Chainlink was the pioneer at Oracles, and they enabled the first generation of DeFi. And they're still used today on stuff like Aave. Lending protocols that don't need high fidelity or low latency updates. The architecture is very different. Chainlink will effectively grab data from the open internet, and then they will ensure that the transmission between the open internet and whatever blockchain they're targeting is accurate by having a set of redundant nodes who are all replaying the same information. You've got about 100 nodes or so in the Chainlink network, but those nodes are not financial players. They're just running a piece of software, and that software is actually pointing to a specific website. So think about it as 10 people all publishing the price that they see on CoinGecko to ETH. And then there's a schedule that gets put in place on how often they have to publish, because there's this gas burn that's going to be associated with it. And as a consequence of congestion, over time, that project has had to reduce the amount of times it's updating. And so it updates once every 24 hours or every 50 basis points. So it's not a high, it's not a product built for high fidelity. It's not a product built for low latency. It's built for an app to be able to be very simplistic. And so the benefit for someone like who's built like an Aave is you actually don't need to do anything other than look on chain to a specific contract. And as long as you don't mind that it updates only every 24 hours or 50 basis points, it's going to update consistently at that frequency. And so because like collateral is not moving so quickly on those lending protocols, they're able to use it. However, if you wanted to build something that benefits from having faster block times or lower latencies, then this model doesn't work. There's another issue with the model is that each chain ends up being its own cost center or environment. So on Ethereum, Chainlink nodes are pushing there on this frequency, but then they have to go and push different data onto Polygon or Avalanche or other chains at different frequencies. And each one comes with a gas spend. And you end up getting this kind of tragedy of the commons because it ends up being sponsored, but the nature of blockchains is such where anything that's published is usable by everyone because it's disseminated to all the validators. And so if you go and charge one person for the sponsorship of this, everyone gets to use it. And so there's like this inherent conflict between the business model of being profitable and then the quality of the product that gets sent out, because I can go and sell you a sponsorship for $1 million, but I'm now on the hook for the variability of the gas cost. So I actually want to reduce the amount of time that I'm publishing so that I can retain some of that $1 million. So the architecture for Pith is designed very different. So we have our own layer one blockchain called Pithnet. It's a fork of Solana. It's an SVL environment. It's the very first SVM that was created as a fork of Solana. It's validated by the publishers in the Pith network. These are all institutions. There are hundreds of them today. All the large trading firms, exchanges, some banks now, who are all publishing data as well as validating the chain. And everything gets aggregated together in this public blockchain. There's 500 symbols. They're done at a little bit faster than the Solana mainnet time, so about 300 to 200 milliseconds. The prices update. And they're able to then be delivered in a verified container to any blockchain that Pith connects to. Today, Pith is connected to 55 different blockchains. There's 350 applications that use Pith prices, and there's about 3 million prices that get sent to different blockchains every single day. What's cool about this is it gives you the exact product irrespective of the chain that gets added. So if we added a 57th blockchain tomorrow, it would have the same type of access to Pithnet data, all 500 beads, updating at the same frequency. And then the economic model is built into the protocol as well. Each one of those 3 million updates that comes across to the different chains per day ends up paying a fee. Of course, today, given where we are in the state of adoption of crypto, those fees are set super low, but governance can choose to update those fees at any given point if we get into a more mature cycle within the market, but it's already baked in. Mm-hmm.
And big firms have been doing this for a while. You talk about milliseconds, like what the difference is, and it can mean millions and millions of dollars when you're trading large volumes. And so how does this differ from how a traditional data feed might work for traditional finance? And is this something you guys had to invest millions of dollars in to move quicker? Or is that based off the blockchain? You find efficiencies there in the cost?
The heuristic that time is money is a really good one for the way that you think about the value of market data. So there's about $7.5 billion in revenues in market data that the exchanges earn. But all the world's market data is free at some point as well. And it's usually after 15 minutes. So like you could draw in your mind like this simple chart where it's like the data is maximally valuable at time of zero and the decays at some function of time going forward. And there's like this steepness to the decay curve, right? And it kind of filters out pretty quickly. There has been a couple of books and movies written about like high frequency trading, but like one story or anecdote I can give you about that is there used to be these fiber optic lines between New York and Secaucus and Aurora in Chicago. And then they started building the first microwave networks. And these guys, the McKay brothers, basically built this microwave network without having a trading firm. They're just like, we're just going to make the fastest network. And it'll force all the trading firms to have to buy access on this, because if there's a faster way, then everyone has to use that. That's like a good example of, you can always make money by making things faster in the traditional world, because there exist deterministic trading strategies. For instance, the correlation of the S&P index and the S&P future tends to be around one. So if the underlying 500 symbols move up in a way where, but it may move up faster than what the future did, then those are going to coalesce at some point in the future. And so you can basically make that bet. You sell the one that has already moved, you buy the one that hasn't moved. So everyone knows this, and just all you need to do is just be the first person to be doing that. And so there's just games that you play to try and reduce the latency. Everything from that communication cost that gets stripped out to like in the colo itself, you want to have the closest box next to the NYSE's box, and you want to have the shortest wire. And then you actually want to get rid of the computing cost. So you basically put in these field chips, like these FPGAs, and you embed onto the chip the trading strategy, since it always does the same thing. And then if that works really well, you actually, instead, because there's some like latency loss in the FPGAs, you then go create an ASIC chip with the trading strategy such that it's optimized for the location on the chip itself, because the FPGA is not like, it's field programmed. You can move it by having somebody go and do it. And then you just strip out all this latency. and then there's other things that you can do, like you experiment with bouncing signals off the atmosphere using shortwave, and you figure out how much packets you end up like optimizing for. There's some things that are better suited for like sending across certain types of channels. If you need to do your orders over a fiber optics line, you just send signals over. So there's tons and tons of stuff.
Yeah.
But what I'm going to tell you is really interesting, because none of that stuff matters within the crypto world just yet today. Because in the crypto world, in everything I've described, you approach physics and that's where you stop, right? Everything is just like physics fast is like the end result. So it all bumps up against speed of light. The way that modern blockchains are constructed today is there's global distribution of nodes. It's pretty universally accepted today that a good network has pretty uniform global distribution. And that adds to things like resiliency and censorship resistant and redundancy and so on. It's a healthy thing to have. A consequence of being so globally distributed is that your block times can only get down to about 200 to 300 milliseconds due to the speed of light going around halfway around the earth. So as a result, your actually baseline is around 200 millisecond updates, which is vastly different than what you can get. You can get into the microseconds. You can do nanosecond processing, but you're basically around to a microsecond for a lot of the trading strategies in the traditional world. So it's 2000 times slower or more than what we're dealing with in traditional finance. So as a result, you don't need to do all this optimization. You actually get the benefits of dealing with a much slower block time that is the fastest in its day. That may change in the future, and then we'll probably have to have these optimization games. And that's one of the reasons why the PIF network is created, is because it's trying to resolve this problem of getting a uniform source of truth for all market data at a time of zero. Today, the fastest you can do that is around 200, 300 milliseconds. If that becomes much lower in the future, PIF will have to change the way it's constructed or the way that the aggregation is run in such a way where it can be faster, or it will lose.
Even talking about the traditional finance space, is there a world where AI starts to predict what the news will be, or is that's not even feasible just because you can't risk that they're wrong? But
AI, I'm sure, is already predicting what the news will be. There's certainly AI trading strategies. When I was at Jump, people would use machine learning techniques. What I think you end up most benefiting from is the more orthogonal, or let's say like less traditional types of correlations are more easily explored within large data sets across different asset classes. That's what AI seems like is pretty good at. The stuff where it's highly deterministic is it's all figured out. And it just comes down to a matter of the physics around it. And there's also optimization. High frequency trading firms look almost more like Amazon than they do a hedge fund that you'd think of on like Billions or something like X Capital, because it's basically a supply chain where there's trying to optimize for the cost of every segment. And so you want to get a good relationship with your supplier. So it could be like your bank. And that's similar to the way that Amazon has huge relationships and they have bulk orders with people, but they get better price points. And so the reason why you've got such consolidation of specific trades ends up being because of the specialization and just the bulk buying of things, like exchanges give you discounts when you're the largest and such. It is a fascinating business to be in, but it's a lot less exciting than you expect it to be, because it seems like nefarious. There's a bunch of people that are using this really crazy technology. It's not. It's usually there's very specific ways with which that trade is going to occur. People can all understand it. But then in order to be the best in the world at it, you need to have a whole networking team or a whole procurement team and a whole brokerage relationships teams. That's what those organizations end up looking like.
One narrative we've seen this year is just the return, or not the return, but the rise of Solana as the chain for retail. And one thing we've seen is Anatoly, who Avi interviewed about 2 years back on Pound of the Table podcast. And it seems like Anatoly had this vision coming from telecommunications that, let me build the fastest chain and that's going to win. And it's very similar to, if you follow college football, you have Urban Meyer's early like Florida Gators in the 2000s. And he's, you can go and recruit talent anywhere, but you can't teach speech. And so do you feel like Pith in the same way?
One of the competitive advantages that Pith has created is being a very fast oracle. But there's a few others. I would say that in order to have the best product, you do need to have super low latency for blockchains. It's a little bit floored by the block time of that blockchain as well. So there are diminishing returns to Pith being much faster than the block times of any other layer one. So if Pith was able to aggregate at, let's say, every 10 milliseconds, if there's no chains where there's a 10 millisecond aggregation, it's not going to be that much better. If there is, you basically need to be as fast as the fastest public blockchains that are being used, and that's sort of it. The other elements of it that I think give Pith a huge advantage is this model where you've got a democratized distribution of suppliers is very new. I want to drill into that just a little bit. When we were first trying to get like market data publishers to sign on the network, there were two reasons why they would want to do it. So the first one was basically because they believed in the Oracle problem, and they agreed that this was going to be a bottleneck to the growth of DeFi and they wanted to solve it. That was for about like 10% of them. And then for the other 90%, it was they're frustrated with the amount of money that they pay for market data. And so everybody else, it clicked immediately on how much money they make on market data. And they disliked that their market data costs seemed to go up every year, and they had all this market data and they were never able to monetize it. So Pith really innovated a marketplace for trading firms and smaller exchanges to start monetizing their market data for the very first time. This was a really cool innovation, and it was built in a way where it's solving a slightly orthogonal problem to financial markets. So we were able to attract firms like Cboe, which makes about $500 million a year selling the market data, because it thinks about this from the, we want to build DeFi, we want to expand our footprint in distribution of market data into this new segment. And those elements of a healthy two-sided marketplace, I think, give Pith a unique advantage over any other Oracle network where it's dependent upon either some open sourced or highly controlled centralized resource. In the traditional kind of Chainlink model, it's depending upon the open internet and whoever those suppliers are. And if it's a free website, or if it's a website that has some sort of subscription, if the terms of that subscription were to change, or if the website's no longer free, those nodes that are publishing the data from the internet onto the website, onto the blockchain, they've run out of a source. And so the intention for Pith was always to create a singular source that was going to be able to answer all these questions. So we wanted to incentivize people to all contribute to the same place. Because one of the things that we thought was going to happen is what we're seeing now. It's large language models have taken over from like the generic questions that you would ask Google. Like before, you would say, hey, what's the weather going to be in? Actually, you may say something about a historical question. And now it's way better to ask ChatGPT or any other large language model to describe something historically for you. And as a result, other websites that might have been giving you an answer for that are going to have less traffic. That incentivizes them to, or disincentivizes them from making their website free and indexable to Google, because they're no longer getting the web traffic that they were getting, and they're, you know, monetized by advertisements and web traffic. We've seen this manifestation through the trend of most publications going paywalled. They will just give you the headlines, and then after the headline, you have to have a paywall. It could even be like a small, like regional newspaper, and you scratch your head. It's because that fishing expedition of let's make everything free and we'll see if the advertising base of the internet is going to be anything like our subscription base has ended. And they've realized that it's not going to work. It's going to be exacerbated because there's even less traffic over time. So as our prediction was, not only is this a shaky business model, because if you started scraping data from like Yahoo Finance, you're going to get sued by NASDAQ. But over time, lots of institutions are going to decide to make their data paywalled and private. And then you're no longer going to be able to do this. So I think that the business model that Pith has created, where private data sets are made available exclusively over Pith because there's a monetizable distribution mechanism, that's really the superpower for it to grow.
Mike, we started doing this thing where we go to someone's Twitter and scroll through the timeline, find some pretty interesting tweets that either you or the company have had. One that was fun, you tweeted back in April 19th. Office thought experiment today. Choose a year and take a time machine to the first person you meet. Say they work in technology. What do they do? Would love to hear your answer on this one. And what was the most interesting thing you've heard from other folks?
Oh man, that was a really fun thought experiment. But it's so cool because you pop out and you're like, hey, what do you do? I work in technology. Great. What is technology? Railroads. And it's fun. The thing that we realized was, prior to the 1850s, we assumed, I think, that most stuff was like war related. So the further back that we went, the instinct was like, it's probably something to do with war. But it was like, it was a fun one where you go back to the 1500s. What do you do? I work in technology. Yeah, it's sailboats. It's like,
yeah.
with sailing technology. But like we had another funny one, which was some of our team said zipper technology, which is fun. If you take any term and you use it in the way like a McKinsey consultant would say something, you'd be like, harnessing the power of zipper technology, we'd like to introduce. So that was a pretty fun one. Would you guys have, let's give you your best year and prediction on those ones.
The TAM is anyone that wears pants back in the day.
If I were to say every male here is thinking about the Roman Empire at all times, and hey, my technology that I work on is like aqueducts, right? And you're just moving water.
Yeah. My dad works in technology. What does he do? Yeah, he works in aqueducts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's super interesting on the side of just also as we, you know, our audience is really looking at like this Web 2.5 of moving from traditional finance, just like you. And it's amazing hearing your story and career as you moved from Morgan Stanley into Jump Crypto. And I think that's where having that lens of like technology is all relative, where if you say, hey, I invest in fundamentals, I'm a very like core conservative investor. Great. But if you thought that way in, say, 1910, 1920s, or no, the 1800s, whenever like Thomas Edison was out there like investing in power lines and, you know, needed capital to do so. Yeah. If you're a conservative investor, you totally miss on this massive technological change. And it's because you thought that he was really out there. You thought electricity was a bubble. You thought, hey, I shouldn't put capital up towards expanding electrical lines across the country. But you really do have to think forward to be like Thomas Edison, who seems like a conservative guy because he's in the 1800s, really was pretty out there for his time.
He was very out there. But I think that you've nailed on it, and a very important heuristic for investing in technology. There is a technological adoption curve, and you can like Google technological adoption curve, and there's like cool charts where they're all plotted on the same thing. But it's always up and to the right. It never ends. It's not cyclical, right? Every time there's a good technology that is improving the lives of people, it gets adopted and just shipped everywhere. You can see it for railroads, for cars, for telephones. You probably had it for chariots and horses and aqueducts and things like that. And it's always the case that more users equals more revenue equals more valuation. And just like in high frequency trading, where it's like the correlation between the S&P 500 is going up. Yeah, that's the one. The correlation between the S&P 500 is going up and the S&P index is going up. Everyone knows that's going to happen. It gets basically front loaded. So you basically have users, revenues, valuation. But everyone knows it's going to happen. So you think that the users are coming in and then the valuations skyrocket. And then there's this period of time where you've just got this super out of sync price earnings ratio. Every bubble looks like that. And really what you're waiting for, what you're hoping for, is that you've timed it right and you're picking when the users are going to come and the revenues are going to follow. They always will. It's just a matter of timing. AI took forever, right? It's only happening now. There's been several AI winters. People have said it's dead, it's never coming, it's 10 years away, always will be, those sorts of things. Now we're actually seeing the users and adoption of it. Crypto is the same thing. We actually have got pretty pathetic user stats in crypto. We've got 2.5 trillion market cap, compare that to about 15 trillion at the NASDAQ. But the users versus internet users, we're back in like 1996. There's about 30 million Bitcoin wallets that are active every month. There's about 15 million on Ethereum, but another 30 on Solana. It's under 100 million. And so those are like 1996 numbers. Now, they could explode very quickly because we don't have any hardware requirements. Everyone just needs to start using a new piece of software. It's the UX continuously gets better. So like the likelihood that we can go from 100 million to a billion in a year is super high, but we just have to have something that catalyzes that. And so that's why these market caps always jump up, because people are expecting that there could be a huge amount of user growth. And there's always that last mover advantage. Like there's Friendster, there's MySpace, and then Facebook joined at the right time. And when you join at the right time of the wave, it's very difficult to be beaten because you're the incumbent. Everyone wants to join and use the new and exciting thing. And then there's this whole network effects of it.
So the last question I'd want to ask is just around, seems like you're very well read, right? So just understanding what has been the most impactful book in your life. I saw you did a tweet about the first principles of humorous perspective and the evolution of finance. The story of kind of the lottery in Babylon. So I don't know if that's the most impactful book.
That's not.
Love to hear from you.
That is a very funny story, very kind of sarcastic version of capitalism. It's a short story. It's 5 pages long by Jorge Luis Borges. Highly recommend it. You can probably pick it up online for free. The most impactful book I've read, if I had to choose one, would probably be, it sounds pretty cheesy, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I just found it to be the book that was able to put together like principles and how to be efficient with time while having integrity to the things that are important to you in your life. And so what I took away from that was how to have a well-balanced life, coming from being a reformed New York City investment banker. All that mattered is work and money. And so I had to build on these other principles, which is like family and other stuff. I would say that probably had the biggest impact.
Yeah, I got to get out of New York myself. No, Mike, it's been a pleasure having you on. I'm really excited. It sounds like you're really building something magnificent here, and really excited to watch. As you mentioned, like, we're still very early. People think that it's been around for a while. The way that technology and everything moves so quickly nowadays, feels like crypto's been around for a while, but it's still at its very infancy in terms of where this can go and the ubiquity. I said it, Jody. I say that every single podcast. But I think...
Love it.
As this proliferation of users, and we create new technologies that make it simpler for reduce that friction, I think, for a lot of people to onboard. Like today, it's still like I'm in the space. I still go to Jody every day. Hey, how do I do this to this? You have to move across different protocols and swaps and things like that. It's very excited. And you seem to be doing a great job over at Pith. So excited to watch your journey.
Yeah, it was really fun to be on that conversation.